From NPR Music, you're connected to All Songs Considered. I'm Bob Boylan, and you're about to hear some of the most important records of the decade.
I fly like paper, get high like planes. If you catch me at the border, I got visas in my name. If you come around here, I'll make a more day. I get one down in a second if you wait. I fly like paper, get high.
Over the past few months, contributors to NPR Music have been combing their collections. They've been reading listener nominations and putting together a list of the decade's most important music. Not our favorites, but the music that made an impact. On this show, I'll have conversations with many of those people, including Tom Moon, Meredith Oakes, and Stephen Thompson. We decided to make this entire list, this best music of the decade, alphabetical, not numbered. We saw no way really to compare, let's say, a classical passion with a Radiohead opus, or pianist Jason Moran with the Grey album. We make these lists not to exclude, but to turn people on to music we feel is worth hearing. We also make these lists so you can tell us which music you're passionate about by posting it on the NPR site, and then others can chime in and go looking for the suggestions that you make. None of us that made this list agree on everything on it, that's for sure. We all had favorites that didn't make it, and there are some on there some of us didn't even care for. It's the nature of the beast. But there's a ton of good music to spend time with, and I bet there are things you never even heard of waiting to be discovered on this list. And you can read this entire list and hear the songs and make your comments at npr.org/decade. So joining me now is Tom Heinziger. And Tom, you've been with NPR doing classical music for 10 years or so?
A little over 10 years,
you're
right.
At Performance Today before now working on the NPR website, doing classical music on the NPR website. And much of what you see and you hear, these concerts, these conversations, are because Tom Heinziger cares a lot about classical music. And so we went to you, we asked you what it was that we were missing. Why don't you pick me a classical piece that we all really should know and hear?
Well, I think one that is a little bit indicative of how things have opened up in the classical world with help from the internet, that our ears are much more open now. So let's go back to the year 2000. That's a decade ago. And that was the 250th anniversary of Johann Sebastian Bach's death. Somebody, I forget who, there was this project. They chose four composers to write a new passion, which is a formula that Bach used for his St. Matthew Passion, for his St. John Passion, these large religious pieces. And one of those composers was Oswaldo Golijov. And he came up with something I think we'll hear now, very different from the Bach model.
What do you want to hear?
I just love how the piece...
It opens?
How it opens, yeah. with these kind of Brazilian rhythms,
cool,
and with these clarion trumpets, and it seems like you've just... like you've faded in on some kind of ritual that has always been going on and that will always be going on.
Love the driving force that's going on there.
It really sweeps you up and into the piece. What I love about this is there's these cross-cultural intersections all over the place in here. I mean, you've got Oswaldo Golijov, who's an Argentine Jew, writing music about the Christian story of the trial and crucifixion of Jesus, as told by St. Mark. And then the music is in this kind of passion formula, but it's really kind of this cross-cultural fiesta with Afro-Cuban rhythms, songs, mixed with some more traditional Western choral singing and Afro-Brazilian styles. It's great. It's a party.
What's the title of the piece?
Well, in Spanish, I guess it's called La Pasión Según San Marcos, which is... just means the passion according to St. Mark.
That's the open. So let's see where... Give me some samples of where it takes us.
Why don't we go on to Cut 8, and that has a distinctly Afro-Cuban feel, and it features the Brazilian jazz singer Luciana Souza. And this is the part in the story where the woman anoints Jesus's feet and head with oil, and the apostles are bummed out about that because they think that the money could be spent for the poor.
Great.
Okay.
if you put that on without any context, Tom Heisinger, I would have not taken that as a classical music record. Does this make people angry in the classical music world? Does this excite people? Where does something like this fall?
This is the good part of the last 10 years, is that I think our ears are more open to this, and we expect that. You have records like the Yo-Yo Ma's Silk Road Ensemble and other classical groups like Brooklyn Rider and others who are really embracing other sounds and mingling classical and, for lack of a better term, world music. This piece is one of the early ones to do it in a large format, in this bizarre passion format, and I think it worked really well.
You want to give us one more little...
Yeah, so you don't think it's all just one huge party. Let's go to...
That's kind of the depressing part of the record.
Let's go to cut 13, and this is a little more traditional Western sounding, with the soloist and chorus in this beautiful, beautiful call and response, and this scene is the communion at the Last Supper. Beautiful, isn't it?
It really is. Do they get to stage this in many places? It seems like a mammoth project.
They have. They have staged it. I don't know how far, frankly, they've gone into actually staging it with costumes and things like that, but it does get performed.
And tell us one more time, Golijov's...
The Passion According to St. Mark, it was released on the Hensler Classic label in 2001.
None of the classical music records that made it on are actually from a traditional... classical recordings. There's no Hilary Hahn playing, you know,
Brahms,
right? Which was a great record.
That's true. Yeah, it's true. But I mean, I had some more traditional stuff on my list that didn't quite make it. One favorite of mine was a recording of Wagner's opera Tristan und Isolde with Placido Domingo starring. And not only is it just a fantastic recording, but it's a little bit indicative of what we were talking about in classical music in the last decade, in that this was rumored to be the last studio opera recording that would be made because they're too expensive to do. And of course that rumor is false, but it's a fantastic recording, and Domingo just proves once again that a man who is in his, you know, mid and late 60s is fantastic.
Thanks for doing this.
Sure, my pleasure.
Tom Heisinger, he's a producer here at NPR Music and is responsible for some of the great classical music coverage over the last many years here at NPR, and a good future ahead.
Thanks, Bob.
Bye-bye. So now we move to the world of hip-hop. There's been a whole lot of music coming out this year, and we talked about this on All Songs Considered last week, which is that so much of hip-hop has crept into so many different genres of music. And here to help me talk about some of the great music that came out hip-hop-wise, most important recordings of this decade, is Franny Kelly. And Franny Kelly, you edit lots of the content on the NPR Music site, you do radio pieces for NPR Music, and you have a real passion for hip-hop. And so thanks for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
So if I just real big picture for hip-hop music, which has been, you know, a form of music that's been so popular for so long now, this decade, Lots of development, lots of change. What do you think?
Well, it's been tricky. I think it started off really well, and it rapidly went downhill. And it's been hard to watch, but also...
What would be the marker for the downhill? What would be...
Oh, man. When I think of, like, novelty rap, I guess the best example is Soulja Boy.
Right.
Because, you know, yeah. It's just, like, it's fun, it's nice. You know, he kind of makes us all look bad.
Not on the 50 list here.
not so much.
And so, good stuff, beginning of the decade. Who would you pick?
I thought Outkast's Stankonia, which came out, like, in the fall of 2000, was just amazing. It was a breath of fresh air. And, it had all this possibility for crossover appeal, but, like, really great dance music that made you think. You know, Bombs Over Baghdad is just an amazing, amazing song.
One, two, three. Yeah, Inslum National, underground, thunder pounds when I stomp the ground. Like a million elephants, a silverback, orangutan. You can't stop a train. Who wants some? Don't come unprepared. I'll be there, but when I leave there, better be a household name. Brother man telling us it ain't gonna rain. So now we sitting in a drop top soaking wet. In a silk suit, trying not to sweat. Hit somersaults without the net. But this be the year that we won't forget. 1999. Stay street. Big things happen every time we meet. Like a track team, crack team, dying to geek. Outcast bumping up and down the street. Slam back, Cadillac by 5-8-75 MCs freestyling to the beat. Cause we get drunk, stay drunk at the club. Should've bought an ounce, but you caught the dub. Should've held back, but you told
That's
the
great.
I know, right?
We'll put the whole version up online for you to hear, which is the case of most of these 50 that we'll talk about and the ones we'll talk about today on All Songs Considered. Yeah, and then the Miss Jackson was on that too, which was the more pop hit. It's almost like another band. I mean, it's
that video is on heavy, heavy rotation. Uh-huh. I remember that really well.
If Outkast represented the new and fresh of what happened in the beginning of this decade, toward the end of the decade, who would that be?
I think it's got to be Lil Wayne, who really was sort of just coming out of nowhere as like a 17-year-old in 99. And now, you know, in 2009, he's selling millions of records. His sound is very distinct. You know, he has this really kind of creepy growl, like gnarled sort of kid's voice. And his rhyming is incredibly complicated. The way he thinks about things and the way he sort of flips the meanings of words and separates them.
Incredibly prolific.
God. Oh, yeah. And, you know, not scared at all. You know, he will rap against anybody, with anybody, over any type of beat. You know, he's really challenging himself all the time, which is, I think, you know, what Outkast was doing.
Would he be a characteristic of what we hear in Southern hip-hop music?
I think that...
he's New Orleans.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that impetus to do it all on your own and not rely on a major from New York or something, they have that in common.
And he was doing that with his mixtape. When you say he's doing it on his own, it's just really in a nutshell, explain people don't understand this, because it's really pretty amazing.
Because they have this independent spirit and local, like, identity in the South, you know, he didn't get caught up if somebody stole his music or whatever. He just said, okay, I'm going to release it this way, and took advantage of all these changes in the internet and the way people share music to, you know, he didn't even care if somebody got his album for free. People still bought the actual CD. Millions of people.
Wow. This record didn't come out many times because it leaked out, right? I mean,
exactly. You know, like half of it leaked in 2000, and so he said, fine, you know, here it is, and here's four new songs, go at it. And then he made a whole new album the year later.
Amazing, and made a lot of money.
I hope so.
So what should we play?
I think you got to play Emily, which is just so weird, and also was imitated by everybody, like, immediately upon release.
Magnetism. Yeah, money.
I'm a young money millionaire, tougher than Nigerian hair. My criteria compared to your career just isn't fair. I'm a venereal disease, like a menstrual bleed through the pencil and leak on the sheet of the tablet in my mind. Cause I don't write this, cause I ain't got time. Cause my second minutes, hours go to the almighty dollar and the almighty power of that chopper. Sister, brother, son, daughter, father, motherfucker, copper. Got the Maserati dancing on the bridge, bitch. Poppin' telecoppers, ha ha ha. You can't catch them, you can't stop them. I go by them goon rules. If you can't beat them, then you pop them. You can't man them, then you mop them. You can't stand them, then you drop them. You pop them, cause we pop them like Orville Redenbacher. Motherfucker, I'm ill. Yeah. A million here, a million there. Sicilian.
I can't think of anything else that sounded like that.
I know, it's just crazy, you know, and he's ripping apart what makes a beat, you know, and what he can feel comfortable rhyming over. But weirdly, people were all over it. People were remixing it, rhyming over it, freestyling over it, to the point that right, you know, before the election, there was a track that said, Obama, 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 Obama.
And I guess that's the best form of flattery. As an important record to inspire lots of people, and that's sort of what Lil Wayne's done, for sure.
Yeah, I think so.
Everything from the unimportant, the clothing, the fashion stuff, to the crazy beats, the good stuff.
Yeah, and the willingness to take a risk.
Right. That's great. Thanks, Franny Kelly.
Thanks, Bob.
It's kind of like a clubhouse, you know? People, it's like revolving door, people coming in. Welcome, Lars Gotrich. Lars, for those who don't know, we've had Lars on, former intern of Also. I'm sorry I do that. It's like having a kid saying he's
I've been here for 3 years, Bob.
Oh, no, I shouldn't say that anymore. Okay. He never was an intern here. I don't know who he is. Lars is an intern for All Songs Considered, but really produces a lot of the great content on NPR Music and has particular tastes, I think, that it's refreshing because it's just left of just about everything else. And we don't want to peg you, but because if I say that, you're probably going to go jump into the mainstream next. So
right, you know.
He's Mr. Contrarian, so we like that about your tastes. And there weren't that many. I mean, you pick a list of most important records of a decade, and you're not going to have much contrarian stuff on there. I mean, it's going to be
the stuff that people love, the music that people really connected to. So, like, me trying to fight for the stuff that kind of was bubbling up for the underground was a little bit of a battle.
Uh-huh.
But a few things are popped up on there.
Well, let's go with something right off the bat that you were really happy is on this list that may not have made this list if it weren't for that striking Viking in you that took hold.
I think the sophomore record from Burial, Untrue, that was one I told everybody I was going to fight for.
And why?
Why? Oh, gosh.
Should we hear just a bit of it?
We should hear a little bit of it just to kind of get people like a kind of a context for what it is.
Okay.
Burial is a UK producer named William Bevan, but that was never the point of this project. The point was to be anonymous and ambiguous, and that's what I love about this music. It's very deep. It has like this intense groove that kind of hovers above your head, which is kind of the point of the genre that Burial was coming out of, called dubstep, which is basically The root of it is bass and sub-bass textures with a nice little clicking beat, which you heard in that song. Untrue wasn't a pure dubstep album. It took from a lot of UK-based electronic music. What's so important about this record, not only did it bring the prominence of UK electronic music kind of to the forefront of everything, Untrue kind of had this universal feeling about it, this universal feeling of ultimate sadness and grief. This you could hit on immediately. Reportedly, he would just get friends to sing over the telephone and leave a message on his machine, and he would just create these ghosts of songs.
Do you think that this record had an impact on other people making records?
I think we're still hearing that. This only came out 2 years ago. Yeah. Already, we have something called post-dubstep. I mean, dubstep did kind of evolve in the beginning of the decade, but I don't think it really hit off until Burial's first record, which was self-titled. I really do think that the music that Burial is making and the music that's kind of coming out of this London scene, I think out of all the genres that like came to prominence this past decade, it's the one that's looking forward the most. It's thinking about texture in a much more concise way than rock or pop music ever has.
And this is one person doing all this.
One person.
That's great. Now, another one, we have as a team of people who put this list together have been fighting back and forth about certain things, and one of the things we've been fighting back and forth about is we knew Animal Collective had to be on the list, but everybody loved the Panda Bear record too, and so we thought we can't have Panda Bear and Animal Collective. I mean, that just seems like too much, but really not, right?
Panda Bear's Person Pitch and
Panda Bear is in Animal Collective for those.
Panda Bear, yes.
I made an assumption there for other people. Yeah,
Panda Bear's Person Pitch and Animal Collective's Merryweather Post Pavilion, which just came out at the beginning of this year. They are two different records, but they're also coming from the same place. The funny thing is that I've read interviews with all the musicians involved in Animal Collective, and none of them are necessarily like really interested in like the internet and things like that. Although the music they make espouses what has happened in music culture in this past decade when it comes to the internet, because their music takes everything, literally everything, but somehow makes it into this streamlined, beautiful mess of noise, also completely accessible.
And very communal sounding. I mean, yeah. it's not an unwarm feeling, which is... Which, when you describe that mess, you could think of it as a cold and rigid thing, but it's not at all. There's a very chanty kind of thing that happens on both records.
It's very joyous.
Yes, joyous.
There's nothing angry about the music they're making. They're very excited about this, and as a result, the fans are very excited about it. And I really think, because the record that we're going to mostly talk about right now is Person Pitch, when I first heard this record, I really thought this is how music is going to be made from now on. I was completely inspired by Noah Lennox, who is Panda Bear. I was inspired by Noah Lennox's use of samples. It reminded me of back in the 80s when hip-hop introduced the idea of the sample as a hook. But instead, Noah Lennox is using the sample and loops as a means to expansive songwriting. And, it's weird and it's jarring just to see him in performance when it's just him in front of a board twiddling knobs. But I'm just enamored with it.
and it takes a very inorganic thing, which is sampling, and turns it into a very organic sound. I mean, I think... Maybe it's a cliche to talk about Animal Collective as a very organic sounding band, but you have to say that in the context of what they're using, the tools they're using to make this stuff, because it's incongruous in many ways. You wouldn't think old analog synths and samplers and all that stuff would make a sound that sounds like it could be coming out from the middle of a forest, you know?
So we should just listen to it. Let's listen to Bros off of Person Pitch.
Oh, good. That's actually my favorite, too.
Great.
Okay.
Woo! Thank you.
piece goes in many, many
12 minutes
directions. And I think heavily inspired by Beach Boys, and you hear that a bunch in a lot of music. I was pushing to get the Smile record that was done in this decade finally onto the list. No one else would.
Nobody in the audience. Yeah. As much as I adore that record, I couldn't support it for this decade.
But I thought it was influential on a lot of records, and I think it's influential on this record too.
Definitely. I mean, I am sure that Noah Lennox heard the Smiley Smile demos and all that stuff.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Loris Godrich. Thanks for doing this, and hope for another great 10 years.
Thank you, Bob.
Joining me now to talk about some of the jazz on the music list on this 50 most important recordings of the decade list is Patrick Jaren-Watanon. And Patrick's been instrumental for many reasons to NPR Music recently, but most recently for helping launch and create a blog supreme, the NPR Jazz blog. And Patrick, if you look at the decade in music and you took the subject that you love so much, you take jazz, if you go thumbs up, thumbs down, good decade, bad decade, where would you go?
Well, you'd definitely say a good decade. And there's so much music right now that it really is incredible, and it's coming from everywhere. It's coming from...
And you mean everywhere? You're talking about geography? You're talking about genres?
We're talking about geographically. It's coming from New York, of course, but it's coming from Europe. It's coming from the middle of the country, the West Coast, you know, all over the world. There are really interesting, you know, cross-genre, cross-cultural collaborations going on. And there's also lots of music which is very forward-thinking, too. Forward-thinking not just in these guys are playing some really wacko free improvisation sort of stuff, but forward-thinking in combining, you know, the language of the entire jazz tradition that's developed so far with modern pop music of today, or...
Who would be an example?
Well, how about the Bad Plus? You know, they had a record that came out called These Are the Vistas, which was a very important record. Everybody had to react to it in some way.
What's that?
Well, you'd have to talk about their pop covers, of course. They did three pop covers on this record, one of a Nirvana tune, the other of an Aphex Twin song, and the other of Blondie's Heart of Glass.
Which is a great version of that song.
I think so. And their Nirvana tune, Smells Like Teen Spirit, you know, was the Nirvana hit of a generation. And they had the audacity to reinterpret it. And not just play it as a novelty, they really departed from it and used it as a way of, you know, expressing these very individual textures of their own.
Let's listen to a little bit of it and then come back and just talk about the Bad Plus and These Are the Vistas, which made it onto the top 50 most important records of the decade. And we'll talk about the polarization maybe of the jazz community with this record, because it's not the only one that was like that in this decade. Further in the cut if we wanted to, and it gets more out there, and like you say, it takes on its own life.
Well, yes, yeah,
sir. Oh, this part, yeah, right. Fun to see, too.
very much so. You know, these guys, whenever they come to Washington, D.C. here, they play a rock club, then they play the 930 Club, which is another, you know, interesting thing that this group does.
Loudest jazz record I've ever heard, I might say.
Very much so.
Compressed to the max. That bass is so incredibly upfront and in your face. I don't know how they mic that thing, but you hear everything about that bass.
It's a very interactive band. You hear that bass like pounding at you, and the drums are like clattering away. There's all sorts of like fun percussive noise and activity going on in the background. It was produced by Shad Blake, who was a noted rock producer, of course, and recorded at Peter Gabriel's Real World Studios. You know, this American jazz trio of three white guys from Minnesota and Wisconsin go to the UK to record this jazz album.
So the nugget of why it's important?
It was fun. It was funny in that, of course, you know, there's a certain novelty value in hearing this music like this, but it was serious. And it wasn't terribly serious in a sort of academic way, but it had serious musical content behind it.
It wasn't novelty. It was just, it put some humor in jazz. It
was right.
Never bad.
Which is never a bad thing.
Yeah. So let's go to another pick. There weren't many jazz picks on this list. There were a lot of jazz records that came out. Only two made it. So Bad Plus, and some would call that almost a rock album. But and then the next one, fairly indisputably a jazz record.
Yes, it's by another percussive piano trio at its core. It's a record by Jason Moran, the pianist. It also invites a guest instrumentalist onto it. I'll get to that later. This record is called Black Stars. It came out on the revitalized Blue Note label in 2001, and it also had this certain postmodern quality to it.
What do you mean by that?
He has this way of combining all the elements of jazz at once, if that makes any sense. So there's a tune here by Duke Ellington. It's called Kind of Dukish. But even on that particular track, you know, he takes this Duke Ellington thing and he adds this very modern kind of funky backbeat to it. And then when that tune ends and runs its course, he goes into a vamp based on Chopin's Funeral March, which is also another early Ellington trademark from a tune called Black and Tan Fantasy. So he's combining these Ellingtonian elements with a sort of abandon, but he hears it as working out in his head, and he makes it work. He also reworks a Thelonious Monk tune called Skippy on this record. It's called Skitter In.
Let's listen to it. This is from Jason Moran's record called
Black Stars.
And Jason Moran writes, I mean, we talk about the cover tunes. We did that with Bad Plus. They're often the touchstones that take us into a record, you know, but he writes an awful lot of his own stuff, yeah?
Sure. You know, most of these tunes are actually originals. He writes in a way which is, it sounds like a Blue Note record in a way. Well, in the 1960s, Blue Note became famous for having this sort of inside-outside style, meaning that it tried to take the creativity and unbridled out improvisation, so to speak. And there were people trying to rein it in some ways with harmonic concepts and song forms. And I think this is akin to that spirit here. He's working with these song forms, which are loose and knotty and complex and jagged, but they work.
That's great. So Jason Moran, Black Stars, Patrick Jaron Watanon, and thank you for this.
Well, thank you, Bob.
And a Blog Supreme, so the name of the jazz blog. And we'll move on yet to another genre. Thanks, Stephen Thompson. So this is kind of like a clubhouse. I've been sitting here, people coming in. You know, when I was little, I would sit at home a lot alone and play records. This is a little more fun.
Did anyone ever come over?
Do I have to talk about that?
I'm really glad to be able to help you work out these issues, Bob.
What does a W on your shirt mean anyway?
That stands for Wisconsin.
Oh.
Which is a great state and also a great university.
And a great state for the artist known as...
Oh.
You want to talk about music?
Wait, that was a segue. I thought we were making small talk. I thought I was going to talk to you
in
about...
In that small talk, I found the segue.
I was going to tell you about the greatness of my home state. Well, my home state did spawn certainly one of my favorite records of the decade, but also... what is ultimately turning out to, I think, be a very influential record, which is Bon Iver's For Emma Forever Ago. And we've talked about this record over and over and
play
over
the tape.
Again. And we could go back and we could weave together, you know, 10 minutes of me droning on about this band. But to quickly summarize, Justin Vernon, the lead guy in Bon Iver, his band broke up with his girlfriend. He goes to a cabin in the woods in the dead of winter in northern Wisconsin, which, boy, I can tell you, is a bleak time. And
this wasn't a joyride.
And he took his recording equipment and the songs that he had in his head, and he made this absolutely wonderful, intimate, very emotionally rich and beautiful record.
I'm sure a lot of people have gone off and they've made records on their own, but this one really clicked. It got a lot of buzz because it was really, really good and different.
I think that's the thing. I mean, I don't think it's necessarily anything new that a musician, you know, gets dumped and writes a record about it. You know, that goes back as long as there's been music. Yeah. But part of it is...
There are stacks of those on our giveaway pile.
Exactly. And just as I'm sure there are a lot of records that are made in unusual settings, there are certainly plenty of musicians who like to isolate themselves when they're writing or when they're recording. But ultimately, this is just a beautiful, beautiful record.
And what should we play?
We should play Skinny Love.
Great.
So my love.
taken a break from this record, and God, it's so good to hear it again. Okay, we won't wax on too much about it, but it really is.
I do think it bears noting that he's made a bunch of songs since this, and a lot of people asked when this record came out, how do you build on that? How do you react to that? Do you keep dashing your relationships on the rocks in order to be able to make records? And what has stood out for me, especially, he put out an EP at the beginning of this year called Blood Bank, and those songs are much more. There's much more of a contentedness about them, and a much more of a, they're much happier and more hopeful, and they're fantastic. So the guy's going to keep making great records, and the sound is evolving. It's getting a little more rocking, and they've gotten better and better and better.
And now
it's,
as a band, I mean, that's the other thing. Right, mostly done. Maybe there's some post production going on here, but mostly done in that cabin by himself, and then he's formed a band, and that's a whole other dynamic. We saw him live, you know, South by Southwest in 2008,
and I've seen them a few times since. Yeah. And that band gets better and better, yeah. And their arrangements get more and more interesting. It's very exciting.
Now you have done something here I don't think anyone could have, which is you've taken the two polar opposite things, which is, you know, something done in the isolation of a cabin, and then something done in front of almost all of America.
In front of just all the people.
Including probably somebody in isolation in a cabin.
I guarantee you that a lot of people are exposed to this show in complete solitude.
So you've picked Kelly Clarkson, and yes. Tell us, what was important about this?
Okay, I picked Kelly Clarkson, and obviously not just because of the quality of the record, which I think the record I picked is called Breakaway, and I think it's a fantastic pop record. It's fun. The production is terrific. They're just these big, bam, the songs just hit you. But also as a representation of the larger phenomenon of American Idol. And it's interesting because we just had a discussion show about the decade, and Carrie Brownstein.
Oh, this is your chance to get back.
This is my rebuttal.
Hang on, let me call her up. Dear Carrie.
Bob's hanging up the phone. He was going to use to call Carrie and have her yell at me. My rebuttal to Carrie at the time was piffle. But she basically made the argument that American Idol stood as this monolith that true artists were able to sort of react to, that it sort of was the machine against which people could rage, and that was where she saw its value. So if you decide that this is the monolith against which true artists rage, it also stands to reason that this is the monolith, and this is what the one of the very few things that people are really all watching.
Right. That we talked about the fact that there's very, very few things that people just gather around anymore. We know that. That's been 20 years.
Right. And that's been going on, this sort of shrapnelization of media and of culture, to the point where we all have the thing that we like, and it's we listen to it on our headphones and we don't share it. And each person is into micro genres, and they watch, you know, their certain show on a certain cable channel. And the fact that American Idol is this absolutely gigantic thing that I come into the office. I work at NPR with a bunch of snooty latte sippers, and tons and tons and tons of my coworkers watch American Idol, and I sit there, and as you know, you sit right by me and Robin Hilton. Robin Hilton and I immediately, you know, have this debriefing session.
Well, you guys came to my house to try to.
we even did a viewing party at Bob's house, which was very much like taking the Amish to Times Square. but I think there's just enormous excitement and value just in having something that everyone, you know, people watch it and take sides. People watch it and to develop rooting interests. They develop crazy conspiracy theories, and the fact that it's also been an incredibly dominant force in terms of what records people are actually buying. I mean, it has made a number of huge, towering pop stars. What's interesting to me about Kelly Clarkson is that not only did she become a huge star because of American Idol, but I think she went through the decade making really great, really fun records like this one. And this song, which I just think is indisputably fantastic.
I don't think I've heard it, so.
You tell me if you think it's indisputably fantastic, but this is Since You've Been Gone.
Here's the thing, we started out friends. It was cool, but it was all pretend. Yeah, yeah, since you've been gone. You dedicated, you took
great pop song, absolutely no doubt. I mean, it hits all the buttons, right?
Absolutely.
Right at the right moments. She's got passion in the way she sings. The players are really good. I like the way it's all put together. I wonder if this wasn't part of American Idol. Forget the TV show for a minute. Forget mm-hmm. that America came together and wanted this artist and loved mm-hmm. this artist. Would this record be an important record just as a piece of music?
You know what? I'm going to say yes.
Okay, good.
I'm going to say, if anything, I think it would be easier for people to view this as a fantastic pop rock record because it's not associated with something that a lot of people dismiss out of hand as somehow inauthentic. If you're like, oh, American Idol is what did Carrie say last week? Is, you know, crass and it's anti-art and it's all commerce and blah de blee. If you don't get to make that argument to put down this record, it's a lot easier to take this record at face value.
And
I think the hooks on this record are enough that it would be a huge hit, and we'd be talking about it in part because it grabbed people and people loved it.
That's great. Thanks, Stephen Thompson.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So one of the records that really surprised me this year was a collaboration between Alison Krauss and Robert Plant, and I thought, this could really be a miserable record, or it could be a really great record. They're both incredibly talented people, but could this work? I think it did, and with me is Meredith Oakes, who I know loves this record as well. Hi, Meredith.
Hey, Bob.
Wasn't that a surprise?
I think a lot of people were scratching their heads over this union. You had this rock legend, this rock and roll screamer in Robert Plant, and Alison Krauss, her voice is just like honey.
Yeah.
And she's just this darling of the bluegrass world, this wunderkind string player, much loved, much awarded. It just seemed really counterintuitive, and yet it worked. And I think the catalyst was the producer, T-Bone Burnett. He made
absolutely.
It work.
Absolutely. And the sound of the record was, it's T-Bone, you know. The detail and the warmth of the record. When I heard it, it all sort of made sense to me because I remember listening to Robert Plant and Sandy Denny, right? I mean, and you had this gorgeous honey voice and Robert Plant in the Led Zeppelin and the Battle of Evermore song. So,
well, the thing about the two of them, and something that a lot of folks miss, but of course we didn't miss it here, was that both of these folks are obsessed with roots music. Mm-hmm. Robert Plant obviously loves the blues and African music. Alison Krauss kind of occupies this singular space in bluegrass as a fiddle player, just channeling this very pure kind of music. So together, you know, these two great like American art forms came together really nicely anyway. Their voices sounded great together. And then T-Bone Burnett just totally took it over the top. He gave the whole record the right vibe, the right texture. He picked the musicians, great bunch of musicians, including Mark Rebo and Norman Blake and Mike Seeger. He chose the songs as well, which
were
really nice selection of tunes. And the whole project was just a phenomenon. It won 5 Grammys, including Album of the Year, Record of the Year. And I think that part of the reason why it was so great, I mean, it was obviously a great record, but I think that a lot of grown-ups, Bob, are looking for CDs to buy, and they don't know what to buy. And here they had two recognizable names together, this sort of familiar sound, because T-Bone Burnett's one of these producers who puts his sound stamp on the records he works on. And it gave, while kids are busy downloading singles, grown-ups want to buy an album. And so this gave them a really good album to buy, and they sure bought it.
What do you want to hear from this?
Let's do Please Read the Letter. It's actually one of the originals on there that Plant wrote. And I mean, there's a lot of nice covers on it. There's Gene Clark and Mel Tillis. But let's do a Plant original.
Great.
Cut out rain. Just a little too much to hide. Maybe, baby, everything's gonna turn out fine. Please read the letter, I nailed it to your door. It's crazy how it all turned out. We needed so much more. Too late, a fool could read the signs.
Maybe, baby, you better check between the lines. Please read the letter, I wrote it in my sleep, with help and consultation from the angels of the deep.
I love the sound of the song. I love the way the instruments all fall into place on this. You know, and you were talking about T-Bone Burnett as producer. You know, the Oh Brother, Where Art Thou soundtrack is something that, you know, preceded all of this. Producer's key. Other records on our 50 most important records of the decade that the producer was the key for you, Meredith?
Well, we got to talk about Amy Winehouse, right. Back to Black. Amy Winehouse, a total hot mess. I love her. And her first CD came out when she was 20 years old. This is the CD Frank. Great CD. You could clearly hear that this girl had extraordinary vocal talent, sang like Sarah Vaughan and Billie Holiday, this little skinny white girl from London. But the second album, Back to Black, she had the same producer working on it, but she also had Mark Ronson. He's a really interesting guy, born to a very well-off family in London, moved to New York as a teenager, became a DJ and a record producer. So along with the first producer, Salim Remy, who she's still working with, Mark Ronson really brought this next album, Back to Black. He took her over the top, I think, because Frank was a good album. Back to Black, an amazing album. Mark Ronson paired her with the Dap Kings, I believe, this funk soul revivalist band that backed the singer Sharon Jones. And with Amy Winehouse, they made this incredible, also totally Grammy-winning phenomenon. 5 Grammys, including Record of the Year, Song of the Year. And the one I consider the Kiss of Death, the best new artist. A lot of people consider it the Kiss of Death. You know, when you say best new artist, you just want to follow it up with, dunk, dunk, dunk.
What do you want to hear from Amy?
Oh, you know, I love this whole album, but we got to do Rehab, because this tells the story of her life. She's now as famous for drug and alcohol addiction and her emaciated body as she is, and her terrible relationships and her bad marriage and all that. It is sad, because the girl is incredibly talented. She's very young. You know, Back to Black came out, she was 23. And how many artists, Bob, have a website dedicated to them like this one, which is called When Will Amy Winehouse Die? I mean, it's terrible. We are, like, obsessed with derelict rock and rollers. There's so few around. People got obsessed with her whole life. But really, she's a very, very talented artist. And I guess we've all heard it a million times, but we got to play Rehab because it really tells her story.
Great.
They tried to make me go to rehab. I said no, no, no. Yes, I've been black, but when I come back, no, no, no. I ain't got the time, and if my daddy thinks I'm fine, they try to make me go to rehab. I won't go, go, go. I'd rather be at home with Ray. I ain't got 17.
In a way, Meredith, the three records that you've picked, we're going to go to the third one. The first two all have a look back in many ways, a look back to old-timey music, R&B. You picked the third White Stripes record, White Blood Cells.
This was tough. I was really struggling between White Blood Cells and the third one, and Elephant, which is the fourth one, which really got 5 stars from Rolling Stone, made him famous. But we've had some
fights here.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure there's actually been fisticuffs at NPR over White Blood Cells versus Elephant. But I have to go with White Blood Cells. It's, you know, the White Stripes, You got to admit, one of the most compelling rock bands of the new millennium. The whole, the red, white, and black color scheme really jarring to the eye. The whole, are they brother and sister? Are they husband and wife weirdness?
And then the great guitar playing.
Right. And aside from all of that, if that didn't all grab your attention, the amazing guitar playing of Jack White. Now, Jack White really fascinates me because he took this garage band. It was a garage band. They came out of the Michigan garage scene. Really, a lot of great bands. But Jack White always had something more. And what that was, he had this real love of blues and country. And beyond the love, the ability to play it and to use it. And he kind of took the posturing of garage rock and he made it into something so much bigger. Although what I love about White Blood Cells, ironically enough, is it's more garagey than the future stuff. So to me, this is the perfect White Stripes album. It has Fell in Love with a Girl on it, which the first time I heard that, I thought, oh my God, is this guy having an apoplectic fit? What's wrong with him? but it's also as famous, you know, we talk about the visuals. And again, I wouldn't even be thinking about the visuals if I didn't love the music so much. But the video for this song was that famous Lego video. Uh-huh. And, you know, who doesn't love Legos? Yeah. So in a way, I associate it as much with that as I do with the song itself. But this is just before they became huge, you know, just before they went over. But to me, it's the perfect White Stripes album.
Cheating now, red hair with a curl, mellow roll from the finger and the eyes were beeping. Can't keep a whip on the girl. Two sides of my brain need a hell of a meeting. Can't think of anything to do. Yeah, my left brain knows that her love is fleeting. She just looking for something new. Yeah, I said it once before, but it bears repeating now.
Let's see if Tom's here. He's supposed to be on this line here.
I've been listening in.
Hey!
Hey, you guys.
Thomas.
Oh, come on. Elephant is so much bigger. It's so much.
I know. As an editor of Guitar World, you'd think I would have gone with Elephant, right?
I'm shocked and appalled that you did not. But I love you for sticking with your guns. I love that because you can't be wrong in either direction on that. You just can't be. I mean, they're both amazing records.
On this whole top 40 list, Tom, you know, the only one act got two records, and we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about Radiohead, and we could have done that with the White Stripes. It really was quite. There are a lot of debates going on this list. 50 important records. It's hard to narrow it down. Where do you start to drop stuff? And
sure,
I mean, look, that White Stripe record was number 51, you know. It's all I can say. We're going to get the letters. I know it. But thanks, Meredith. I love these picks. These are great.
I love them, too. Thanks for having me.
Okay, bye. And Tom, so Radiohead, the only group to make two on a list, right? We it was really hard.
And you could almost have four.
Well, I would have only done three, you know. But I think we've talked about my lack of love for Hail to the Thief. But maybe one day when I grow up, I'm going to love that record. But let's talk about the Radiohead that kicked off this decade. You and I worked on a piece in 2000 for All Things Considered on Kid A. And whenever we did these reviews together, you wrote them and I would help produce them. I would listen a lot to the music as much as I could, and this one was not hard to do because I fell so instantly in love with this record, more than any other Radiohead record to date.
Yeah, and it starts off, everything in its right place. It starts off in such a way as to almost bring you into the movie, not with like an overture and a whole bunch of stuff, but actually sort of throw you right into the action of it. And these guys were making cinematic records before this one, but this to me is the one where, you know, every song's a movie.
And it also changed the role of the guitar in this band, which I think gave them a whole new breadth and scope, don't you think?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, you could actually plot Radiohead's development alongside Johnny Greenwood's development as a sound wizard.
Yeah.
And where they start to really come together is Kid A. And this is the first time where he's really thinking in sort of bigger orchestral terms for the guitar. He's not necessarily thinking about playing rhythm guitar the way they did during the Bends, for example.
Which disappointed an awful lot of people, but, you know.
Well, yeah, and look how long it took for people to sort of come around to it. I mean, really, it was only in the last few, you know, you could argue only within Rainbows did people start to realize, wow, this is amazing.
So what should we play from Kid A?
Oh, boy. Well, you know, if we're in that sort of up-tempo thing, maybe everything in its right place. But the moment on this record that I think sort of says this is a band that is swinging for a different fence from any other thing that ever happened before is The Morning Bell.
Inspired so many others, you know. That's both the good and the bad of being a breakthrough band and doing a breakthrough record like this.
Without this record, I mean, I'm sure Coldplay would have existed, but you know, there's a case where you can trace a band like that and their sonic philosophy almost directly back to this.
Right. So we talked about early Radiohead. Should we talk about In Rainbows?
why not? You know, and that, and there, it's interesting. I hope that it ended up on the listener lists as well.
Oh, absolutely.
It, because here's another case where these guys did not stay still. They did not, in fact, make another Kid A. And in each record that's come since Kid A, there's been a sort of new dimension revealed. And I think that's the same way within Rainbows. I mean, even people that I know that don't tolerate Radiohead in large doses, which is hard to believe, but there are those people, they would hear some of the stuff on this record and just have to give it up. I mean, this is, first of all, Thom Yorke being
in
much
a good
more
way.
In a good right, in a good way, and have to acknowledge that, you know, these guys didn't stay still. Thom Yorke's writing much more sort of open, transparent, almost vulnerable at times lyrics. There's a sense of this Johnny Greenwood atmospheric stuff that he started to do on Kid A, finally coming around and blossoming into these you can't even believe it's guitar that's mm-hmm. actually making right. these sounds.
Yeah, it was great to see it live. It was good, sort of good to try to, well, to try to figure out what the heck was going on stage, because you'd see the guitar player playing, but you wouldn't quite be hearing what you would think of the guitar sound, and it would swirl all over the place. And it's the kind of music I love. It's got that what's going to happen next feel to it.
Right, and density. You know, some of the stuff that they had the strings do is very much atonal. It's like, you know, sort of half steps stacked on top of each other and stuff like that. And when you listen sort of on a microscopic level and you try and drill down deep and pick apart the different sounds, you realize these guys really spent a lot of time thinking about how things should be situated in the mix, how all the sort of like small under the hood kind of nuts and bolts questions.
What should we play?
Oh boy. I mean, you know, one of those moments that really shows Thom Yorke developing is the waltz called Nude, which is just beautiful.
I'm for a waltz. Let's go for it. The Wonderful Waltz from In Rainbows, Radiohead. I'm talking with Tom Moon, and we're talking about some of the most important records of the decade. And, you know, Tom, I'm glad we spoke about Radiohead and we spoke about this record, and we didn't talk about the other reason this record was so important, which is... which, of course, is how they wind up distributing it. And I don't want to talk about that too much, but you can't... It is a seminal album for that reason as well, yeah?
Yeah,
and then,
absolutely.
And then the other model for that is another one I know you want to talk about, which is the Wilco record. And let's try to just weave these two things together into the reason these things are important.
Well, first of all, we are in a time of enormous flux in terms of how music is getting to people who want to listen to it. And the notion that Radiohead took, and Nine Inch Nails and some other people have done it too, is that we are not going to employ the distribution models that have not worked so well in the last decade. We're going to just figure out some other way to get paid from these records. And for Radiohead to say, all right, here's a tip jar, put in what you think it's worth. You know,
it's the NPR model.
Right, exactly. And a radical one, and at a time when we can't actually tell what music is worth to people, why not let people decide for themselves?
And not have all the people in the middle taking their piece of the pie, too.
Well, exactly. And those people who are in the middle have been, in varying degrees, responsible for some of the muck that we're in now. And, you know, when you eliminate them from the equation, what we have here is a very simple circuit where creators want to create and audience members want to participate in that creation. And they want to support their artists. And how we do that in the main, how the whole industry gets that together, who knows? I mean, it feels yet a ways down the road. But I think that one of the reasons we will pay attention to this Radiohead record is that they did this and it was viable and it worked, and it showed another path that if you are true to your art and if you don't care about the, you know, sort of saturation coverage of getting into every discount store, you may actually find your audience and reach your audience in a much more happy way, and which is, of course, what we all want. And the connection that I feel with Wilco is that Wilco wanted that same thing and came upon a record label that said, no, we don't hear this. And
we don't hear this music.
Right. We don't hear this as viable music.
And no one else can either. Well,
and, right.
You know,
and
unless
we are,
you want to do it.
As, and in our role as gatekeepers, we are going to say that this is not releasable. And
key for me. I'm so glad you use the word gatekeepers, because that's what's disappearing. And
that's right.
And you have to give, on one hand, credit to record labels who did sign, I mean, Capitol signed Radiohead, right? And Reprise signed Wilco. Look, we work with these people. We know these people. A lot of them are really music-loving folks. But
right.
There's also a lot of people who are stuck in ways that are really just not for these times. And right. They are gatekeepers in a world where the world doesn't need gatekeepers anymore.
That's right. There needs to be no one in between that circuit between the artist and the audience, like we're saying. But to go back to this other idea that the labels did have a function, let's tip our hat, because we wouldn't have gotten Kid A or In Rainbows
That's right.
out of Radiohead had there not been people with a little bit of patience and a little bit of vision and a little bit of willingness to take risk. And I think that's what's missing, and that's what Wilco bumps up against when Reprise says this is not releasable. Wilco says, oh, no, we think it is releasable. So at that point, they get rejected. Wilco takes the record, puts it up on the website, lets people hear it for a little bit, and generates interest. Well, ironically, some of the interest in the record company world comes from another arm of Warner Brothers Records called Nonesuch Records, and Nonesuch wants to put it out, believes in it the way it is, and it becomes the biggest Wilco record in their career to date. To that point, I should say.
Right. And we talked about this one in a backwards way from Radiohead, which is we started talking about the music of Radiohead, and I'm really glad we did. The music for Yankee Hotel Foxtrot. We wouldn't be talking about this record if this was not one of the most brilliant records of this decade, in my opinion. Sonically, as the Radiohead record is, maybe it's the kinds of things that I look for in records, but and the people who are writing into the website love about it, but over and over and over again. sonically,
that's right.
People love this record.
And it is truly, you know, it's a great kicking down the door of the major label system story, but it is more, and it will endure longer, as just plain old great music. And this is the case of a band that has actually figured out, or is wrestling with at this point, a whole bunch of other ways to make the sounds surround the narrative of these songs. And Jeff Tweedy writes great little miniature songs, and you can hear them solo on acoustic guitar, and mm-hmm. they are transcendent. But when put in these kinds of settings, and as they've grown from this record, what I say about Yankee Hotel Foxtrot is it's the seed from which a bunch of stuff that has sprouted since. It's where you see it in seedling form. Not to say that it's not developed there, but it, some of the guitar stuff that happens on A Ghost Is Born and subsequent stuff is actually in Yankee Hotel Foxtrot. And I just think it's one of those rare cases where we are watching a band build its vocabulary in one record and come upon a vocabulary that is completely different from anything that they had done before, or at least not, you know, different enough to be significant and thrilling. And you can feel in the backing tracks behind Tweedy that these guys are thrilled by it, and there is this electricity of new discovery happening here.
And we tip our hat to someone else, Jay Bennett, who decade made some of the great music with Wilco, and we lost them this year. Thanks, Tom Moon.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, that was fun.
And you can hear most of the songs, read the 50 most important records of the decade list, and comment at npr.org/decade.
I am an American aquarium drinker. I assassin down the avenue. I'm hiding out in the big city blinking. What was I thinking when I let go? Let's forget about the tongue-tied lightning. Let's undress just like cross-eyed strangers. This is not a joke, so please stop smiling. What was I thinking when I said it didn't hurt? Baby, hold on tight. You were so right when you said I've been drinking. What was I thinking when you said good?